All right. Good morning, everybody. It is Monday, September 13th, and 11:20 a.m. We're doing Chem 12B, and we're picking it up with alkenes where we left off, which means I need to sort of figure out where we left off. So let me get into the iPad. Screen share. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, I don't know if you guys noticed, but that last lecture I did, so I'm going to speak too soon. I'm going to knock on wood real quick. That last lecture that I did didn't have one single dropout from the iPad. And with a new computer, maybe dropouts are a thing of the past. We left off. Let's take a look at where we left off. So we were doing this free radical mechanism. And we had gone through and we talked about the free radical mechanism and how it is that the free radical, the bromine adds first, and then the hydrogen adds second, which gives us a an anti-Markovnikov looking addition. So in other words, when we go through with the alkene and the bromine is added, HBr is added with peroxide, the bromine adds first, generating the more stable free radical. And then that more stable free radical picks up the proton and grabs the proton in this step to then produce the product. And so it goes through the more stable free radical. And this is one of the things, we have an entire chapter on free radicals, but it's worth it to spend a moment here to talk about free radicals. Because this is the first reaction where we're actually looking at a free radical. And so what is a free radical and how do free radicals move and propagate? So first off, when we look at a free radical, the way that we draw it is with the single dot. And the idea is that when we look at a free radical, there are several options. One option is that it could be sp2 or that it could be sp3. And the question is, which do we expect? What do we expect for a free radical? Do we expect it to be sp2 or do we expect it to be sp3? And you have an orbital here that is essentially a p orbital. I guess we could look at it this way, is that this would be an unhybridized p, or this would be an sp3 hybrid. And we have the two options. And the question is, which one is correct? And the answer is that it is this guy that is correct. That when we look at free radicals, that free radicals exist in an sp2 hybridized state, and that the single electron exists in a p orbital. And that allows us then to take that and say, okay, well, if a free radical exists in an sp orbital, then this is most similar to a carbocation, because that's exactly the way that a carbocation looks. So structurally, they're very similar to carbocations. And that actually kind of makes sense that when you look at it, that a free radical is electron deficient. And because of that, it's very much like a carbocation. And all the things that stabilize carbocations also stabilize free radicals. Let's do that over here. Because they are structurally similar, they have similar stability issues. So if you take all the things that you knew about carbocation stability, more substituted equals more stable, more resonance equals more stable. That all of these things that we knew about carbocations can be construed to be understood in terms of free radicals, that they're just very structurally similar. And their resonance patterns are a little bit different. We need to look at how their resonance patterns work. But when we look at carbocations, if we look at a primary carbocation versus a secondary carbocation versus a tertiary carbocation, you know, that we know that these things are in the other direction. That this is most stable. And the same is true for free radicals. So we're looking at primary, secondary, tertiary in terms of the free radicals. And in terms of resonance, when we look at resonance and the way that these work out, if we take an allylic carbocation, then we could show the allylic resonance with that carbocation. And we say that those are resonance contributors. We can do a very similar thing with an allylic free radical. But we have to be careful of how we draw the resonance with an allylic free radical. So with the allylic free radical, the way that we move electrons is to break the bond homolytically and to take only half the electrons. And so we use the fishhook arrows, and it takes three arrows to move a free radical as opposed to the single arrow that it takes to move a set of electrons for a carbocation. So here this requires three arrows. But in all other ways, the resonance is the same, and the outcome is the same. And so we could look at free radical resonance just in the same way that we look at carbocation resonance. And the end result in terms of making things more stable is also the same.
So Jason, if we have something that's SP hybridized, do we not have any resonance stability at all, or?
No, that's a great question.
We always have to have it at SP3 hybridized for that resonance.
Here is here's something that is, well, let's do it with the carbocation first. So your question is about SP hybridized. So this is an SP hybridized carbon, as is this carbon here is SP hybridized. And there is resonance between them, such that we create an allenic system. This is the way that we draw the allenic system. And that places the charge. Let me be a little bit more clear. Being a little more clear, I can draw the hydrogens that are in there. And the hydrogens that are there and the hydrogen that is out here on the terminal end. And that makes it a little bit more clear. And so the dot does not represent a free radical. The dot represents the center carbon. And these carbons that are here and here, these are still SP hybridized carbons. And this carbon that is out here is SP2. Notice that the hybridization did not change with the resonance. that what was sp2 remains to be sp2, but the location of the carbocation changed from sp2 to sp hybridized in terms of the location of where the positive charge is. So sp hybridized carbons can participate in resonance, and a positive charge can appear on an sp or an sp2 hybridized carbon. The free radical can do something very similar. And in fact, free radicals are identical in their resonance forms. It's just that free radicals have some options that are not available to carbocations. So that's something that I need to show you. So the way that we would do the resonance here is we would break the bond. We would take the electrons and we would swing the electrons around that way and out that way to the tail end. And we would create the same allelic system. And the same free radical. And where this was sp2, and these two were each sp, this is sp2, and each of these are still sp in terms of their hybridization. So sp2 versus sp3 doesn't really matter in terms of resonance. It still works just fine. The difference is, so key difference, and usually we cover this in the resonance chapter.
Can you scroll back up,
please? Sure.
Thank you.
So like I was gonna say, the key difference in these is more with traditional electron withdrawing groups and how electron withdrawing groups operate with free radicals. And that's a key difference. That normally, let me know when you're good, Travis. Normally what we would say is that oxygens as an electron withdrawing group.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Would function, for instance, this way. If I have an oxygen that is here and a positive charge, there's no way for the oxygen to resonance donate to the positive charge. And so this becomes an electron withdrawing group by induction. If I move that positive charge, well, let's do it with the free radical too. Because this is true from the free radical. I move the positive charge here as a carbocation, now what I get is direct resonance and the positive charge moves to the oxygen. And this is stabilizing. What I had going on up here before was destabilizing induction. Okay, but with a free radical, if I put a free radical in the same position, I can't get that resonance, or I don't get resonance in the same way, because I can't push two electrons to it, or I can't do a free radical mechanism. Maybe I show it this way. If I try to bring this in and bring one of these in, what's the problem with this?
You're breaking the octet rule?
Yeah. The problem's here. Oxygen has 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9 electrons. It's a broken octet rule. So we don't get resonance in the same way, but what we can do is we can get a different type of resonance. So instead, the way these systems work is to do this. Here's my free radical. Here's my two lone pairs. What the oxygen does is give away an electron. It gives the electron away. And in giving the electron away, it creates the anion. And it creates the cation. And this is stabilizing, but it's different than what you would think. And you can extend this to oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, halogens, anything with lone pairs. That's the type of resonance that we see. So it's a resonance where an electron has to be given away. We can't do the formal resonance that we've done before, where we just move a lone pair into it because there's an existing electron there. That is problematic in that the oxygen takes on more than 8 electrons, and you can't take on more than 8 electrons for a period 2 element. So period 2 elements are restricted to 8 electrons only, octet rule. So that's where we see the resonance with those. All right. This is a very prominent type of resonance, though, and is very stabilizing. It's just different than what we expect to see. And we'll go through these more when we get into the resonance chapter or get into the free radical chapter. There's an entire chapter on free radical mechanisms. So we'll do that in more detail. But I think that's enough detail just to show how similar they are to carbocations, in that carbocations have the allylic resonance, so do free radicals. SP versus SP2 really doesn't matter. Key differences are that the induction works the same. So inductively withdrawing groups function the exact same way. It's just that when we get into resonance with these lone pair containing elements, that the resonance happens in a slightly different way, but the resonance is still there. It just doesn't look as familiar as it did before. It's just a slight difference in the way that we see resonance from other things. Okay. That takes me from free radicals and oxygens and HBr into, I don't know, where do we go? I think brominations, and looking at just straight up bromination or halogenations. So let's look at addition of bromine and how addition of bromine works. Halogenation. This is Br2, Cl2. They both sort of do this same sort of trick. So here what happens is when we do halogenation and we do it with bromine, what we wind up getting is bromine adding to either side. But what's interesting about it is that if we take something where we have restricted rotation and we add the bromine across it, what we find is that we get a specific type of substitution pattern. We get the trans.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
When we do bromination, does it always have to be in the presence of light and heat, or can we also do without that?
Light and heat generally causes free radical reactions. And so bromination, the difference from this is that there is no light and heat, or at least there is no light needed. The difference between that and this reaction, which is something that we do later on, is that if we take Br2 and light, that it adds in the allylic position and does not add across the double bond. And so this is a reaction that you're remembering, I think, and confusing with the one above. And so this is different.
Okay.
We'll come back to this. All right. So that's a different sort of, this is free radical. And these mechanisms up here are not free radical. And that free radical nature of the reaction really does change the reaction and how the reaction works. So that's important to understand. The fact that we get trans only out of this reaction means that this reaction is both regio and stereospecific. The stereospecificity means that this is an anti-addition, or the type of stereospecific specificity that it is an anti-addition. So we need to look at that mechanism and understand how that anti-addition works. All right, so that's a key aspect of this reaction. Mechanism in this, best seen through the five-membered ring system. When the five-membered ring system reacts with the bromine undergoes an instantaneous polarization. It is very large, it's very polarizable, and it has van der Waals forces, and the van der Waals forces are induced dipole forces. That means that this guy here is going to act as an electrophile. And the double bond is the nucleophile. The electrons reach out, grabbing the bromine. Let's do that in red just to make it more clear. Electrons reach out, grab the bromine. Bond breaks, bromine takes electrons with it. Lone pair of electrons cycles back and rebonds to the six-membered or five-membered ring system, or at least to the other side of the alkene, because it happens regardless of ring system or not. In binding to that ring system now, this is the best way to see it, we get what's called a cyclic bromonium ion. The cyclic bromonium ion is an intermediate. The bromide comes in and attacks either side because this one is symmetrical, opening up the cyclic bromonium ion. And we wind up then getting an SN2 sort of step here. Backside attack. And that backside attack then means that I get an anti-addition, that I get addition from one face and then the other face. So this bromide comes in, the hydrogen is down, the other bromide is down, and the hydrogen is up. And this is the anti-addition. So what happens if the bond is not symmetrical? What happens if the bond is asymmetrical? Is a good question. And what are the preferences when the bond is asymmetrical? So what can happen here is we can choose a five-membered ring system that has a methyl group in it. And we can go through and we could do the same reaction. And in doing the same reaction, essentially the same thing happens. The electrons reach up, grab the bromine. Bromine reaches back down, returns electrons, and kicks out the bromide. Now here, this is asymmetric. And the asymmetric means that there is more partial positive on the tertiary center than it would be on the secondary center. This is more stable. More stable than if I were to draw it this way. Putting the bromide firmly attached here. This would be the tertiary center, and this would be secondary center. And the tertiary center is much more stable than the secondary center. Now what happens is the bromide comes in, and it does a backside attack coming in from the bottom side here. Let's do that in red. Coming in the bottom side here on that tertiary center, not on the secondary. And in so doing, we get the methyl group up, bromide down, bromide up, and the hydrogen down. Still anti-addition. With substitution on tertiary position. Does that make sense in terms of why it would go that direction? So what's neat about this is that we could do a number of different reactions here. There's some interesting things that we could do. For instance, we could do Br2 in saturated sodium chloride. And because of the mechanism, we can predict the outcome. That the chloride is going to end up on that tertiary position. The idea being that once the bromide added, that we know that the chloride, as it comes in, is going to prefer to go to that tertiary position, as opposed to the secondary. We could also do a reaction that is very closely related to this. This is with HOBR, hypobromous acid. In this case, what happens is essentially the same thing. We've got a big partial positive on the bromine. It grabs the bromine, returns electrons, kicks out a hydroxide. So all these reactions are occurring in near identical fashion. I've got partial positive here, and then the hydroxide is the incoming nucleophile, which does the SN2 step, kicking out the bromide. And I get the anti-addition of the hydroxyl group. And notice that in each one of these steps, that because this was a key component right here, where the second bromide comes in and comes in on that lower step on the tertiary center, that's what we're following, that the same thing happens here, that the second incoming nucleophile comes in on the tertiary center. The second incoming nucleophile comes in on the tertiary center. That's what we're seeing in all three of these reaction mechanisms.
These are all happening within microseconds.
Nanoseconds.
Okay.
Even microseconds. The bond making, bond breaking process happens on the femtosecond to attosecond timescale, minus 12 to minus 15 second timescale. And then these bond makings are happening sort of in that, I would say, minus 8 to minus 10 seconds.
So the intermediate product is for explanation only. We can't really store that anywhere.
No, you can't see the no. It's not a long-lived intermediate. Although carbocations can be observed. You can observe a carbocation in the NMR spectrums. Sometimes we can see their formation. There's ways that we can see that. We can see these cyclic bromonium ions spectroscopically. We can detect them. There are situations or ways in which we can make their lifespans elongated by removing the nucleophile and taking away a nucleophile. So chemists find ways to prolong the lifespans of these intermediates and to observe them and to say definitely they do occur. But yeah, in the course of a chemical reaction like this, where the concentrations are higher, they're not going to have that long a lifespan. Okay, so I think what I'm trying to do is show you some of the similarities in these chemical reactions and in how they're occurring, and that they all occur for these types as anti-additions. Let me ask you another question though now. Let's see how you do with this. So taking what I've taught you, let me teach you one more thing, that if I take a look at chlorine, that chlorine works very much the same as bromine, that the chlorine becomes polarized. It kicks out. That last arrow is not, actually these two arrows are not in a good spot. That's better. It forms the cyclic chlorinium ion. And then the chloride comes in, knocking it out to produce the anti product. And it would be anti-addition. And of course, we couldn't see it unless we chose to do it in a five-membered ring system. And then, of course, when we do the chlorine, the chlorination, we would get one of these going back and one of these coming forwards. Now, what's the difference between chlorine and bromine? major difference. Of course, there's electronegativity.
Yeah. So chlorine is more electronegative than bromine.
Yeah, but there's another bigger difference than electronegativity.
Chlorine is smaller.
Yes, size. Size is critically important here. Size is more important here because what the chlorine and the bromine are trying to do is they're trying to span the gap. So the size becomes critical here in that when we look at a cyclic brominium ion, that I get partial positive on the bromine and partial positive on that center. When I look at a cyclic chlorinium, the chlorine, of course, is bound strongly there and not so strongly here. This has a much larger partial positive and much smaller partial positive, but much larger partial positive down on the tertiary center. That because of its size, bromine can span the gap better than chlorine can. That means that chlorine is more selective. Then bromine for the second incoming nucleophile.
Looks like the screen's frozen.
Thank you. So much for my idea of thinking that it was not going to freeze. It just took longer. I'm okay with that. It certainly snaps back in faster. All right, so size makes a difference in that what we're looking at is we're looking at small partial positive and the larger partial positive in terms of bromine versus chlorine. And so now that we've kind of gone through and we've done these things, let me ask you this question. Let's see how you do with this. If I give you this reaction, and I want to change it . Maybe let's make it that. And I do HOCl. What do I get? What's my product? Oh, it froze again, so you can't see what I did. Interesting. Why is it freezing all of a sudden now?
Did it switch to another network or something?
No, although you're right, the VPN may have kicked in. I'll have to check. I'll check on the VPN in a second. You guys take a look at that and see. See what you think needs to happen there. So I'll let you get that drawn down. Remember, the whole idea is to draw. Take a look at it. See what you think. Let me check my VPN. Nord, where the heck are you? Nord. VPN. VPN is not connected, and I don't want it connected, so we're good. All right, so the two carbons of interest, carbon one and carbon two. What goes on carbon one and what goes on carbon two?
See, the chlorine goes on one because two is, no. No, the chlorine goes on two because one is like a resonance stabilized with a ring.
There you go. Yeah, if we look at it and we try to sort it out, the best thing to do is to draw the intermediates and to ask which is more likely. So we could do the chlorine firmly attached to this side and the larger partial positive here, or the reverse. We could put the chlorine here and the larger partial positive now on the tertiary center that way. And so we have to ask which one of these is more stable. And the answer is that we need to recognize that there is the potential here for resonance, and that this is a benzylic position where this is inductive and this is a tertiary position on inductive. So if I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, all right, here's my inductive nature, is these guys all sort of supporting that inductive center. But over here, what I'm doing is I've got resonance with the lone pair and the whole aromatic ring, which can be electron donating by resonance. And that makes that resonance center the more stable one. And so resonance is always a stronger effect than induction. And that means that when the OH comes in, that the OH is going to come in on that greatest partial positive center, moving the chloride over. And so what we expect to see is an anti-addition, not syn, but anti-addition. Best to kind of do it this way. One of these guys going back, OH, and one of these guys going forward, and that is the Cl. And that would be major. And of course, these are always on a flat system. And so I should get racemic, but racemic, I still want to be clear that it's an anti-addition, not a syn addition. And so I can't, that's not anti, what is that? That's init, anti, there we go. Anti-addition, racemic on the anti-addition, not, I can't just write racemic with straight lines, because racemic with straight lines doesn't mean anything. It means both anti and syn. And I want to be clear that I'm only getting the anti.
But does it matter, because it spins there, doesn't it?
Oh, it does matter greatly. Absolutely, it matters. Because if I look at this as being two stereocenters, so let's say hydroxide group and chlorine group, this would represent, even though I've got free rotation, you're right, it's a sigma bond, and there's free rotation about the sigma bond, but I would get this product where the hydrogen is back, the OH is forward, and I take it back, because of the two methyls, it's only one stereocenter. It's not two stereocenters. Okay, that's my error. We would have to be more careful, because this is not a stereocenter, it's just one. So actually, we wouldn't need to be as careful there. We could just write plus minus, because you're not getting four stereoisomers. It's because you have two methyl groups here. And because there's two methyl groups on this side, that is not a stereocenter. And because of the free rotation, then, and that not being a stereocenter, there's only the chance of getting enantiomers.
So is there any way to verify this, kind of like, except thinking hard about it? It seems like it's very error prone. This kind of like, you know, is there a stereocenter or not? Does the software tell you or something?
No, software doesn't tell you. You just have to think about it.
Wow.
Yeah. We could verify it experimentally through experiment, but yeah, there's not a software that's going to help you with that aspect. All right, so that is one way to do it. Let me give you another way to do it. N-bromosuccinamide. N-bromosuccinamide is a molecule that is an electrophilic source of bromine. And we abbreviate it NBS. And in fact, there's another molecule in N-chlorosuccinamide. So this is NCS that operates just the same, although you very rarely see it. You see the NBS much more common than NCS. So these are electrophilic sources of these halogens. And the bromine is partially positive and the nitrogen partially minus. And they have a dipole moment that sits like that. There's a lot of reasons why we use a reagent like this. NBS is oftentimes used when we want to use addition of some second nucleophile. And it's also used very heavily with free radical. So we'll see them in a number of different instances. But one way to show, or to show how this might be used, I want a six-membered ring system here. Is to do NBS and water. And what this does is it reaches out, grabs the bromine, bromine turns back around, grabs the double bond, kicks out the nitrogen as a nitrogen anion. So the nitrogen anion becomes a nitrogen leaving group. And I'll show you why that's extremely convenient. So there's my cyclic bromonium. And here is the succinamide anion. And that succinamide anion is very non-nucleophilic. It is an immensely stable base. It's non-nucleophilic because of all the resonance associated. So this thing is delocalized. That allows other things in solution to come in and act as the electrophile. Excuse me, nucleophile. So here we see the water then can actually come in and act as the nucleophile, although we do need to deprotonate this. So another water molecule would act as a base, pulling the proton, and we would get the final product. That would be an anti-addition. And we get racemic there. So these NBS, NCS are used exactly like bromine. It's just that they allow us to use a second nucleophile. And oftentimes we can use the nucleophile of our choice to react with the cyclic bromonium. So they're a way of getting to the cyclic bromonium without having to use bromine, which can be very advantageous. So I know a lot of these reactions look the same or look very similar. That's intentional in that I'm trying to show you commonalities between the reactions and how they can be used in many different ways. So the key thing here is to watch for the cyclic bromoniums and watch for the cyclic chlorinians, that they're anti-additions, and that the nucleophile is always going to attack at the more stable partial positive position. So we can say here, addition of bromine and chlorine go by cyclic halogen ion and second nucleophile attacks anti at more stable partial positive. And therefore, watch resonance over induction. That's the key takeaway out of all of those reactions.
So this is kind of what you think about when you look at it. You don't go into the actual mechanism each time you look at a reaction. Like, what level do you usually think at when you see this?
No, I actually go into the mechanism every single time. I always think mechanism. I don't memorize. I don't think about it this way per se. I see more mechanism than I see words. So when I look at it, when I look at this guy going to that, I see this in my head. This is the part that I'm thinking about taking step. And so I think about it stepwise of, nope, I got to add that first. Where's my most stable partial positive? Bring in my second thing. That's how I got here. That's the way that I walk through that. I'm just trying to, I've got no other way other than to put it into words to try to summarize all of these things to show their similarities than to put it into words. But each one of them, that's exactly what I'm doing. Each one of them I'm taking and I'm going, all right, chloride's going to add first. It comes in cyclic chlorinium, more stable partial positive. Which one is the more stable? That's this one over here. Okay, that's where the hydroxyl group's going to come in. Anti-addition for my product. That's the way I think about it. Always go through the mechanism. That's my best advice. If you try to memorize it, everything is going to look like a different reaction. And then every substrate is unique. And so then you're trying to figure out substrate wise, well, where, you know, what side do I need to go to? What did he say? Don't worry about what I said. Just remember your basic stability factors, right? So if you're forming a partial positive or a full positive, it's going to go where that full positive or partial positive is going to be most stable. Remember all those stability factors. That's what you've got to do.
So another related question. So how do you know you're correct? Like in the intermediate states, like, okay, so the chlorine like causes this intermediate, is in this intermediate stage with the charge here. But how do you make sure you got your steps correct? I guess if you get to the right result, you're okay.
It's practice.
Okay.
It just comes down to practice. It comes down to practicing it enough and being observant enough. I mean, my old answer, I used to give a very flippant answer that was not satisfactory. I said, because I have a PhD.
is what you're saying.
But it's practice. That's really what it is. It's not anything special. It's just a number of years that I've been doing it. And a knowledge of this is what you need to look for to become proficient at it. And it just comes down to practice and the right type of practice, right? And so it's not just drawing a product. It's thinking through the mechanism and then understanding where that product came from. That's what it really comes down to.
So in the periodic table, there's lots of options there. How far out from like bromine and chlorine can you go and this still works for you?
That's an excellent question. I love that question. you know, when we look at the periodic table, it starts off at fluorine, and then it goes to chlorine and bromine and iodide. And I forget who's after iodide. It's some big thing that, come on back, where are you? Periodic table. Iodide.
Astatine.
Yeah, AT. Astatine. Usually we leave fluorine out. This guy is too small and too electron withdrawing. So it doesn't do the same types of reactions as chlorine and bromine do. And then there's kind of a dotted line here, and then the iodide, and this guy starts to get too large. And so really the reactions that we stick most of for carbon anyway are chloride and bromide because of their size and electronegativity. Size of orbitals and electronegativity. There's some other things too, some bond issues, bond strength issues, where the chloride and the bromide bonds are of one type of strength. Fluoride carbon bond is extremely strong, and the iodide carbon bond is very weak. And so, and that goes back to the size of the orbitals and electronegativity as well. The polarizability of iodine. And I have no idea about AT. It's just too big and too rare an element that we really don't deal with it. And so what we'll find is that fluoride is its own special brand of chemistry. And there are reactions that fluorine can do that these other guys can't. And we have to use some special techniques to be able to work with fluorine. Chloride and bromide, these are our wheelhouse. This is where we stick iodide once in a while. We'll look at some reactions with iodine, but it doesn't tend to work as easily or as well as chloride and bromide. It's just size and orbital nature of those guys and how they work. So that's it. And that is true of the periodic table in general, that there, while their families and most elements will be very similar, they each have their own sort of spin and flavor, personality. I like to think of it more as personality that they have that makes them unique. So that's a great question. Let's pick it up with a few more reactions. I got a little bit more time here. I think we can fit one more of these reactions in. So let's look at ozonolysis. Ozonolysis, we've got in there. Ozonolysis is one that most of you remember. It's one that sticks in people's heads more than other reactions for some reason. And maybe it's because there's not a whole lot of selectivity to worry about. But in ozonolysis, what we do is we take the reaction and we react it with ozone. And then there's some type of workup. The workup can be oxidative. And there are two general oxidative workups. There is hydrogen peroxide, sodium hydroxide, and then in the second step, we do H3O plus, dilute acid, or we can do acetic acid and hydrogen peroxide, combining the acidic step and the hydrogen peroxide step in one. And then there is a reductive workup. The reductive workups are zinc and water, or dimethyl sulfide. So those are our two reductive workups, and they give different products. So the products can be that the molecule is split in half. And in splitting it in half, we get the oxygens inserted in between this. And we will get different products depending upon whether we do oxidative or reductive. This one we would say would be a reductive product. Or if we do an oxidative workup, we would end up with carboxylic acids. And that would be the oxidative workup. So that's like ozonolysis in a nutshell. There's a little bit more to it than that, but the basics of it are that it goes through an intermediate that is not the intermediate. That's the intermediate. And that this intermediate collapses in different ways depending on whether you go oxidative or whether you go reductive. And how that intermediate is formed and how that intermediate breaks down is not of great consequence. It's not a real important mechanistic feature other than understanding sort of what are the products that can come out of it each time. But that's sort of the intermediate that we're looking at. These reactions, ozonolysis, is a very popular reaction. It's seen quite frequently in the literature. It would seem to be a very mild, easy reaction to do because of how much we see it. In reality, ozonolysis is not an easy reaction to do. It typically explodes most of the time you try to do it, and it takes a lot of practice and work to kind of get it down the right way. So let me show a couple of examples of ozonolysis and what to look for. Let's pick a molecule that has two sides to it, two different sides. We'll pick a side that has a hydrogen and a CH3, and another one that has the two hydrogens. If I do one ozonolysis, and then I do two reductive workup, that reductive workup may be zinc and water, is one of the most common to see. Or Me2S, dimethyl sulfide. Remember what you're doing is you're always splitting. And then we're paying attention in this reductive workup. Actually, in reductive workup, we don't have to pay attention to anything. We just stick an oxygen in the middle. So we make two molecules. And we insert the oxygen in the middle. The same reaction with the same reactant. Done under oxidative conditions. Now we can do hydrogen peroxide, sodium hydroxide, and we need to do an acidification step along with that. Or we could do acetic acid and hydrogen peroxide. It makes a difference here in the substrate. There's a reason why I would choose either the first or the second, and it depends on the substrate and how well the substrate would tolerate things. For right now, let's just imagine that these two are perfectly equivalent. Here, what I need to pay attention to is any place where there's a hydrogen, what happens is oxygen is inserted not only into the double bond, but also to where the hydrogen is. So we have inserted those oxygens both at the double bond and wherever the hydrogen was. On the other side, we do similarly to one side, but not the other. It doesn't insert two oxygens into the bond. It only inserts one. And I think that's really because of the intermediate and the way the intermediate breaks down.
So Jason, it doesn't really matter where the oxygen is inserted on the right structure in the product.
Could be top or bottom, doesn't make any difference. It only inserts the one though. It doesn't insert two. It doesn't go to both.
Oh, because if you rotate, it's still the same molecule.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think that that's really coming about because of this. That there's something about this intermediate and the way that this intermediate breaks down, that when there's two hydrogens here, only one oxygen somehow winds up migrating or incorporating, and one goes the other direction. And I don't know what it is about this structure, but I know that when we have two hydrogens on a side, that only one of them will have an oxygen inserted into it. And that's the way that we look at that. The other thing to be aware of is if the molecule is cyclic, that when we do ozonolysis on this guy, and we can choose to do oxidative or reductive, let's do an oxidative one here. Let's do acetic acid and hydrogen peroxide. That when we split it, we need to be aware that this molecule is linked. And so when the molecule breaks open, it remains linked. So there's our link. And then we insert the two oxygens into that bond. Where there was a CH3 group, the oxidation does nothing, but where there was a hydrogen, I end up with the carboxylic acid. So the hydrogen that's there winds up as the carboxylic acid. And so this molecule, if we number it out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 could be drawn out 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And on number one would be the carboxylic acid. And on number six would be there 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So it could be drawn out linearly or cyclically. This is recommended. That prevents you from making mistakes a little bit easier, but sometimes this is given. So an instance, or as an example, what I could say is, let's say that you were given this. And this is the only product . What did it come from? What was the starting material?
So we have a 9 carbon product.
Okay.
Starting with. So instead of having, so we're still going to have that benzene ring alkene with, instead of being a CH3 would be a butane. Isopropyl group.
There's an isopropyl group.
Instead of, so the isopropyl group would be in place of where the methyl group is.
Okay. So here's what I would recommend doing. Do this. Go through and number them. Start at 1 at a carbonyl. 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Those two are going to link together in a 6-membered ring system.
Right.
And then off that 6-membered ring system, you have the other things off 1 and 6. So that's a better way to kind of tackle it. Once you understand that you've got the 6-membered ring system, orientation then is not so important. We could choose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Between 1 and 2 has to go the double bond. Off of number 6 comes the, I linked 1 to 6. Off of 1 and 6 is the double bond. There we go. Off of 6 is the isopropyl group. And off of 1 is the methyl group. So there's your 2 groups that come off of 1 and 6. And then the double bond goes back between 1 and 6. So that's the way that I would tackle a problem like that, is number between the carbonyls in order to figure out how to put it back together. And then put it back together from that way. All right. You can, of course, just start numbering out here at the terminal end and go all the way to the other end. And then you just have to look at, this would become number 2 and this would become number 7, and you have to link 2 and 7. And then the double bond goes between 2 and 7, and you arrive at the same thing. It just sometimes makes it a little bit more complicated. This makes it easier to make sure you know what size ring you're making and getting all the carbons in there. That's just an easier way to do it. Okay. All right. We've got a few more reactions in here yet. We've got dihydroxylation with osmonium tetraoxide. We've got epoxide formations with MCPVA. We've got catalytic hydrogenation. There's a few more reactions that we've got before we get to the end here, before we get into alkynes. So I think I've got maybe 3-4 more reactions to show you guys overall. And I'll try to get that quiz up today so that we can start rolling on some of those other things. Make sure you're doing those practice problems. I'm going to remind you real quick. Let me stop the screen share here and just show you that if I go back to Firefox and we go back to not that, but the dashboard, and we look at 12B. I want to remind you that in the module here for alkenes, that I put alkene practice problems, and that there's 2 sets of practice problems. There are sort of easier problems. So these are problems like what we're doing right now. These are great ones to work on, and the answer key is of course there with them. So the answer key is there too. But then I've also got some more advanced problems. And so here's a series of problems that are written out as well. And I've got answer keys for this one up as well. Actually, that looks like that might be the key. I may have put those in the wrong order. Anyway, you got a second set of problems. Maybe I clicked on the key. All right. I got to go back and put the problem set in. I've just got the key there. I'll get that problem set replaced in place of a key. But you've got a series of problems here that you can work on in addition to the book problems. So you should be working on the book problems. The OChem as a second language has good problems. And I've got good problems in there in the Canvas shell for you to work on as well. So you've got no lack of problems to work on right now. You should be working on all those Alkene problems up through where we've covered so far. Okay? All right, you guys have marching orders. You know what you need to do.
Practice.
Try working together. Try getting together. Somebody get Brian in on that Discord too and get you guys working.
I was trying to play with that just now. I need to go in there and recover my password, but I'll do that today and then I'll jump in and maybe we can send pictures back and forth on that of where we're at with some of these problems and we can
that works too.
Work through them.
All right. How about questions for me? Anybody got any questions?
So we're ending on O's analysis for today's lecture.
We're ending on O's analysis for today's. I'll pick up with dihydroxylations next time.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about anything with the free radical bromination quite yet.
No free radical. Well, you have the free radical HBr, but you don't have free radical in terms of bromine adding by itself, which is the allylic bromination. No allylic brominations yet.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get those later.
All right.
Okay. Take care, you guys.
All right. Thanks, Jason, for everything. Have a good day.
You too. See ya.
Wednesday.
I do have one question for you.
Oh, sure. Travis, go.
So for that, I asked about that Wiley Plus access.
Oh, yeah.
I know I have stuff to do now. Thank you for that. But like going forward, I'd like to be able to access that so that I can do practice problems in the book and have the answers.
Right. Let me look and see. Hang on a second. Okay, I don't think I can send this to you. Hang on a second.
Okay.